Okay, so we are on page 3, page 4. In the Hebrew, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines down from the wide lines after the note. The word is achbir ha'inyan. Inyan is the last word. And in the English, it's the last paragraph. The explanation of the question raised above can be found in light. Okay. He just got through asking all of his questions. We are now going to go on an official tangent. This official tangent will take us on 13 chapters before he comes back. And in the end of chapter 14, we'll have answered all the questions which he posed at the first part of chapter 1. Okay? And here he's going to tell us what life really is all about. Okay? We can explain all these by first prefacing that which Chaim Vital wrote in Shara Kedusha and Eitz Chaim. These are books that are attributed to the Arizal. Chaim Vital was the Arizal's number one student. The Arizal died at age 36, and he said, "I don't have time to write stuff down." The Arizal once said, had a dream on Parshas Balak, last week's Parsha, and on Shabbos afternoon, that he said that the insights that he saw during this dream would take him 80 years to explain. So he said, "I'm not wasting time writing things down." So this person by the name of Chaim Vital, who's actually older than the Arizal, was chosen to write things down. And this Chaim Vital Zal said, "I'm not the one to do this. I can't do this. I mean, I don't have the brain for such a thing." But the Arizal, knowing better, said, "No, your soul is connected to my soul." And they went down to Tveria, and the Arizal, the story goes, located Miriam's well, and gave him from Miriam's well to drink, which Miriam's well is supposedly in the Kinneret somewhere, and it's like every once in a while veins of fresh water from Miriam's well flows into the Kinneret. And so he gave him some of this water, and suddenly Chaim Vital experienced Moichin de Gadlus, this expansive intellect. His IQ jumped up 100 points. So the Arizal just basically started talking and talked and talked and talked and talked. And Chaim Vital spent the rest of his life writing all this stuff down. And the 20 volumes of Arizal Svarim that we have are because of Chaim Vital. And he didn't write anything with his own name, per se, I don't think, because he was just writing down all the things that he heard from his Rebbe. So what does he write over there in these two places? The kol ish yisrael echad tzadik ve'echad rasha yesh shtei neshamos. That every single Jew, here the word echad means weather. It's an idiom. Echad this means weather.
Weather this, weather that.
Yes, yeah. Weather with an H, yeah. Yes. Not weathering a storm, but yes. Whether they be righteous, whether they be wicked, they have two souls. How can I make such a statement? The absolute most concrete way to prove anything is to quote a
Torah,
a pasuk, somewhere in Tanakh. As it says, now, dichsiv is, there's a difference between kamosha kasuv and dichsiv. Kamosha kasuv means like it's written, which means there's an allusion to it. You could sort of make a... You could justify some sort of extrapolation about it. That's what kamosha kasuv means, as it is written. Dichsiv means because it's written. This is absolute, 100%, this is what this verse is talking about. So we're not sort of like guessing around and there's an allusion to the fact that we have two souls.
And dichtiv means this is an axiom at this point.
Yes, absolutely 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, neshamas ani asisi. I made souls. Souls I made. Okay, now, you might want to come back and say that verse must mean that there's whole bunches of souls
that apply each to different people, one to one.
Yeah, everybody's got one soul, and there's a zillion of these people getting one soul.
Yeah.
Except, you have to take things in context as well. Because there in that verse, he's only talking about one person. So if you look up the verse, you see that the verse is talking about an individual. Mm-hmm. So in the individual, there are souls. Now, the rule in Judaism, the rule in Hebrew grammar is, if you have a plural without a number, it means two. Because what's the minimum plural you could have?
Right, two.
Okay, so there's no, according to I don't know about modern Hebrew, but in biblical Hebrew, there's no reason to say I have two fill-in-the-blank nouns. Because the word two is superfluous. All it just says I have two nouns. I have nouns, mm-hmm. And you know that there's two of them since he didn't say a number. Three already, you have to say three. But just a minimum plural is two. Yeah. So it says neshamas. Okay? There are two souls. And that's Shehen Shtei Nefashis. And these two neshamas are two nefashis, two nefeshes, which in the English he doesn't translate them, he just transliterates them. Okay? Because both of them are translated as soul. Okay? I'm not exactly sure.
And when they're using neshama, is this in a general sense, or we're talking about, in the sense of the levels of the soul, the different names?
This is talking about generally speaking. When you talk about nefesh, ruach, and neshama, that comes up later. So the... that comes up in Perek Beis, where he talks about nefesh, ruach, and neshama, and describes them there.
So he switches from neshamot to nefashot. It's just synonyms. Just
yeah, because nefesh is really what we will relate to. And he's going to talk about later. Neshama is related to the word neshima, which means breath. Hmm. Like, how do you know you're alive if you're breathing?
Yeah.
Good indication. If a guy's breathing, he must be alive.
And the inverse.
Yes. Okay. Which does have halachic ramifications for, like, saving people on Shabbos and Yom Kippur, these type of things. If the guy's breathing, you can save him, but if he's dead, he's dead. You leave him alone, that kind of stuff. We're going to go to that now. He says, but he mentions here that Shehem Shtei Nefashis. And the reason why he switches now and doesn't just keep calling them neshamais, they have two neshamais. Because, you remember, he's not making this up. And he has to use terminology which is written. So if he wants to talk about the relationship between the two souls, the way that they're always referred to as is with the word nefesh.
Yes.
You never see the expression
neshama Elohim.
Neshama habahamis.
Right. Huh.
It does not exist. Okay? So it's called nefesh habahamis because the nefesh is an indication of that part of the soul which is the most cognizant. That which you're most aware of, the part of your soul which is moving you from here to there.
But that this concept, it does apply to the more spiritual aspects of our soul too, right? It's not that I can be oriented towards nefesh behemit in my seichel, in my intellect.
Oh yeah.
At
this point, what he's saying is that becomes now the general term that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Yes, your nefesh behemit has an ability to act, an ability to feel, an ability to speak, an ability to think, an ability to desire. Yes, that's all in your nefesh ha-bahamas, because that's the terminology which he was given. First in the Zohar and then through the Kabbalah.
But the name works best because it's relating to the most important aspect.
Correct. The part of the soul that we relate to the most is the one that gets us to wiggle our fingers and toes. That's the part that we can relate to the most, so that's what he calls it. Okay, so it's we have two nefashis over there. Nefesh achas. Why does he start talking about first he calls it the one soul, mm-hmm. And in the next chapter, chapter two, it says nefesh hashenis, it says the second soul, mm-hmm. Which he could easily have said, one soul is like called this and this. And he could also, it's a proper thing in Torah terminology to say, and one soul is called this and this and this. You don't have to go the one soul and the second soul. So what's the deal with, and why describe the animal soul first and call it the first soul? Well, first of all, I don't know which reason comes first, but the animal soul is a lot easier to describe than the godly soul. Mm-hmm. because we know what it does. We see it. It leaves a trail wherever it goes. And it happens to be the soul that enters into the body at birth. The second soul, the godly soul, that he calls it in the second, in chapter 2, Nefesh HaShenis, doesn't enter the body until bar or bat mitzvah.
Oh.
Where did this arbitrary number of 12 or 13 come around to say that this person is now a responsible adult?
Yes.
Okay, the only thing you could say about this person is that they are adult, but you can't call them an adult. Okay, so as my son got one of his cards that he got for his bar mitzvah was, congratulations, today you are a man, and you open it up and it says, tomorrow you can go back to being a little kid. Okay, and it's not even really expected of a 13-year-old to get it all right.
Mm-hmm.
For 7 years, until the kid's 21, the kid's not punishable. He's responsible for doing all of the commandments, but any type of punishment that's going to be meted out doesn't get meted out until the kid's 21.
You're saying it will get meted out later for sins that he's done in the
interim?
Or he's actually exempt from anything?
He's exempt. That's only between.
And the parents are not responsible.
The parents are not responsible.
So there's actually a halachic break.
Correct.
Where you're responsible yourself, but you're not punishable.
Correct. That's only between man and God. Between man and man. So if a kid steals something, so that the parents have to pay for it. If a 16-year-old hits somebody, so he is responsible for the damages.
And this is just this generic halacha.
This is halacha.
Yeah.
This is straight out of the Talmud.
Okay.
Yes, I didn't know about this 7-year gap over here until I was 21. Someone said to me, "Oh, by the way, now that you're 21, you could have gotten, you know, between man and man. A person to put on tefillin." So God says, "Listen, I understand. His frontal lobes aren't developed. He doesn't feel like putting on tefillin today. Okay, I'll give him a pass. Okay, but he better get his act together by the time he's 21."
So that's a long time to live without nefesh elokit.
You have the nefesh elokit at 13.
Yeah.
But you're getting used to it, you might say. You get 7-year grace to get used to it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and don't tell this to your kids.
No.
No, we don't. It's like, you know, the spoiler. So it comes in first. Now, why can't you just have, you know, there's the age-old joke of the panel discussion among clergy people in the forum, when is the beginning of life? Inviting a Protestant, a Catholic, and a rabbi. Okay, so when does life begin? So the Protestant says at conception, and the Catholic says at birth, and the rabbi says when the kids move out of the house. And I'm sure that joke is told in different denominations and different configurations, mm-hmm. but for Judaism, in Judaism, there's halachic ramifications of this Kabbalistic concept, because we believe that a baby is a baby as soon as it takes its first breath when it's come into the world.
Mm.
Up until that point, it is considered a body part of the mother.
An organ.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay, which means there's certain things you can do, certain things you can't do. Okay, which is why Orthodox Jews can't really support the Christian right when it comes to abortion.
Hmm.
And nor can we support the liberal left on women's rights either.
Hmm.
Because we're sort of like, we're in the middle. Just as it is, a person is not allowed, a woman would not be allowed to chop off her finger because she doesn't like it. I don't like my finger, I'm going to chop it off. I'm not worthy of having 5 fingers on my hand, I'm going to chop it off. All kinds of stuff that, like, people go into self-mutilation and this kind of stuff. Totally and completely forbidden in Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
If, however, this woman has a gangrenous finger, it now becomes absolute necessity to amputate the finger.
Mm-hmm.
To save the life. So being that now we're saying that the fetus, the embryo and fetus, are a body part, it's going to be the same deal. Mm. A woman just can't say, I don't feel like being pregnant. I don't deserve to be pregnant. I don't want to be pregnant. I don't this pregnant, that pregnant, whatever it is. They can't just, abortion on demand, sorry. You get, now because of the internet and whatnot, you can get movies on demand, but you cannot have abortion on demand. However, if the mother's life is in danger, we do what we can to save the mother, specifically. Even there's something called a late-term abortion, which is done during labor. Okay, it's a very graphic, but it says in the Mishnah that if the fetus is posing a danger to the mother's life in labor. You know, back then they didn't really do cesareans. That was like cesarean was if the mother died, we lost the mother, nun nebuch. Let's do a cesarean and we'll save the baby. Okay. That's basically when they did cesareans way back when, because they didn't know about closing them up and saving them blood transfusions. They didn't have all of that. So if it is that we can save the mother's life, it says to cut the fetus into pieces during labor, because the mother we know about, that's a viable entity. Okay, this is looked upon as being, the expression is a rodef, is the expression. You may know that because there are many Reformed temples called Rodef Shalom.
Pursuer.
A pursuer is someone who is trying to kill somebody, that we do not need permission from a police force or based in. If we see somebody has intent to killing somebody, we have permission to act as a vigilante and kill the pursuer. So the fetus is looked upon as being a pursuer.
When the mother's in danger.
When the mother's life is in danger, and therefore we'll allow abortion. Okay.
Now, I had in my head some time that if the head and shoulders is out, that's a different stage halakhically.
Yes, because once the head is out, this baby's breathing by itself.
But it
now it's one on
if
one.
If it's not breathing yet,
by that point, pretty much is.
Okay.
Yeah, at that point, it's now one on one, and one life doesn't. Then you have to try and save both, right, or lose both,
right,
because we can't decide whose life is more important at that point. Okay. It's the same thing also. There's a there are leniencies for embryos over fetuses, because an embryo is not really formed yet. It's before 40 days, and the number of times that a woman gets pregnant and spontaneously miscarries before 40 days, statistically speaking, comes out to be about 93% of all pregnancies. Okay, so most times that a woman is having her period, I don't say most times, let's restate that. It's very possible that when a woman is having her period, she got her period a little bit late, couple 10 days late, whatever, it could have very well been that she was pregnant, but the body rejected it, which is why when we're talking about IVF and all these wonderful things that they do to have child, the childless couple should have babies, they can't get the percentages of working up more than 7%, because in nature it's 7%, and you really can't push nature. So people get discouraged, they do all these things, and they went to all this trouble, and they only have a 7% chance of getting pregnant from all of this stuff, and it's very expensive, and they only have a 7% chance. Well, that's the way the woman's body is. That, not that she has a 7% chance of getting pregnant, that 7% of the pregnancies that she has will go full term.
Okay. So we know that it's Nefesh Bahamid at this point. That's the only thing that's...
That's the only thing we're talking about at this. Till the end of the chapter, we're talking Nefesh Bahamid.
Yeah.
And then in chapter 2, 3, 4, 4, 5 is kind of weird. 5 is a parenthetical statement. So he spends 3 chapters on Nefesh Elokis. 2, 3, 4, and 2, 3, and 4. Okay? And you get a half a chapter on Nefesh Bahamid, because you really don't need to know too much about it. Because you know what? You know about it anyway. Then we have to teach you about this. Yeah, this is our default setting.
Yeah.
Yes. So the so he calls it the Nefesh Achas. Now it's quite a title to be called Nefesh Achas. The word Achas, Echad, really, when you know, we're talking philosophy relating to one God and this stuff, you know, so we're here in this world not for our godly soul. Godly soul doesn't need to come into the world.
Mm-hmm.
The godly soul is perfect before it came into this world. And after this leads this world, it gets the schmutz from all the schmutz it picked up in the course of this world. And guess what? It's perfect again.
Mm-hmm.
The godly soul is not why God created the world. God created the world for the animal soul and the body.
Mm-hmm.
Because they got problems. So what does God do? He takes his godly soul and he stoops it into, packs it way down tight into this animal soul in this body, and then tells the godly soul, okay, get to work, clean up the mess you're in now. Okay, so that, and when a person succeeds in doing that, uh-huh, now they have this like pristine animal soul. Puh, doesn't get any better than that. You just made God the happiest entity in the entire whatever.
It's like finding a bunch of dirty uranium in the ground and then suddenly...
Right, exactly. Okay, ta-da! So, Nefesh Achas Metzad, a clip of a Sitra Achra. First soul, the animal soul, comes from Klippa and Sitra Achra, which you could translate as the forces of evil. Why do we call them Klippa and Sitra Achra? Sitra Achra, he talks about later in chapter 6. Sitra Achra means the other side.
Mm-hmm.
You have holiness, and then you got everything else. The Alter Rebbe doesn't pull any punches when it comes to what a person's supposed to be doing with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's either you're right or you're wrong. There's no gray. And even though he defines this, oh, by the way, this is gray, but as soon as you touch it, it either turns black or white. So you right, never get a chance to have it be gray.
Uh-huh.
For you, it's always going to be black or white.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So the so Sitra Achra, that's an easy term. Sitra Achra means the other side of holiness. You got holiness and everything else. Okay? The forces of evil. Meaning it's holy or it's evil. Now again, the word evil is back up. The translation of the word evil is really bad because that's a Christian word.
Hmm.
Evil means that which is in opposition to godliness. But how did evil come into existence?
Created by God.
It was created by God.
Right.
For an express specific purpose. And I got news for you. The forces of evil, guess what? They're doing their job that they're created for 100%. They get A+.
Yeah.
So they're not in opposition to godliness. They're doing what God wants them to do. Okay, so the fact that we call them, so the word evil is a really bad translation, and I don't like using it. If it becomes necessary, I'll say it. Usually I will say the extraneous forces, or the non-holy forces. I don't like the word evil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The word klippa, where does the word klippa come from? Klippa literally means a shell. When the world was first created, and Adam's in the garden, and we got Adam, we got Eve, and we got trees, and we got a snake over there in the corner over there. So there was no evil in the world. Evil was a protective covering over our realm of existence. It was out there. We knew about it. It was out there someplace, but it didn't directly affect us. Adam wasn't stupid. God told him, don't eat from the tree of knowledge. Okay? It wasn't the tree of knowledge of mathematics. I would render that, it reckon that if you asked Adam a question on, say, particle physics, he'd probably have a good answer for you.
Let me check in one of these little souls in me.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But he'd be doing it butt naked. Because to him, that didn't matter. That wasn't, you know, he couldn't relate to anything else. He didn't know that there was something wrong with being naked. That whole thing of him didn't exist.
Uh-huh.
It was carnal knowledge, wasn't it? You know, you have sex to have babies, and that's, you know, okay, this is what you do. There was no passion or drive or lust in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was out there, it was removed from him. Okay? We use the example of a shell, like an eggshell, for example.
Mm.
Okay? Is an eggshell a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing if you want to take your eggs home from the supermarket.
It's a bad thing when it's in your omelet.
Correct. If you got your omelet, you got an eggshell in it, it's a very bad thing. Which is what Adam did. When Adam took that bite out of that fruit, the entire clipa crumbled. Not it crumbled, it disintegrated into our world. And there was so much of it that the forces of evil look like they dominate this world.
Hmm.
And if you were to put everything on a scale, put everything on a balance, there'd be way more stuff that fits into the category of Klippa than Kedusha. Okay? But as far as quality goes, the Alter Rebbe says later on, Zelu Mazet, everything's in equilibrium.
Hmm.
The amount, the quality of Kedusha and the quality of Klippa is exactly the same. There's always going to be a balance. Where there's a Yaakov, there's an Esav. Where there's a Bilam, there's a Moshe. There's always going to be, as far as that goes. Now, the Klippa, the Kedusha is much, much smaller because it's compared to a light. A small light. If you're in a total darkness and you light 1 watt, you're not in total darkness anymore. And to get it to lighter, you're just going to get lighter and lighter and lighter. You're introducing more of what was there. But you're not in darkness anymore.
Hmm.
Because you just need a little bit of light to push away all the darkness.
Mm-hmm. It's
the analogy with the relationship between Kedusha and Klippa. So it may look like, boy, things are really messed up. There's so much bad in the world. Okay? The amount of Kedusha in the world equals all that bad in the world.
Mm-hmm.
To keep it balanced.
Is that equilibrium? Just an aside. I read in the Torah Parsha with Rashi, when they mentioned the name of the, you know, the Israelite that was sleeping with the woman that Pinchas.
Yes, and they paled them. Yes,
that because when they mention somebody for honor, they also have to mention somebody for negative in a story. Is that related to the same thing?
That kind of stuff. Yes, to balance things out. Yes. Okay. So now. So this one soul is mislabeshes bedam ha'adam lahachiyos haguf. It encloses itself in the blood to enliven the body. Okay, so how is it that there's life in your little fingers and little toes?
From the blood.
It's because the blood is there. You could say it's because the blood is oxygenated, but okay, that's a physical way of looking at it, that oxygen is being brought to the tissues. But we're looking at it that there's actually soul being brought to even the ends of your little fingers. Now he says, like a kidiksiv, which we said that means like kind of, sort of, because so this verse is interpreting
here.
Yeah, this verse is not talking about your animal soul. It says, ki nefesh habasar bedamhi. That verse is talking about the prohibition of eating blood and the reason why you have to salt a piece of meat.
So now we're taking something out of context to use it.
Totally and completely. This is now a drasha.
That is
This verse, the pshat in this verse over here is you need to salt your piece of meat because it's got blood in it.
Yes.
Okay? And why can't you eat blood? Is because the soul of the animal's in the blood.
Hmm.
That's not talking about your animal soul. It's not talking about your body. That's talking about a cow.
Yeah.
And why you have to salt the cow. But he's extrapolating and saying, kidiksiv, like kind of sort of, it's written that the animal has a soul in it, which is transported by the blood.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we learn from that verse. Umenu boys kolmidos rois. Now, how is this animal soul manifest? How do you know you have an animal soul? You're talking about equilibrium, by the way. So I was told before my wedding that when you get married, you get this extra godly soul, extra measure of godly soul. I thought that's really so cool, you know? And then he said, oh, by the way, you also get an extra measure of animal soul, too.
Yeah.
So it's always an equilibrium. Umenu boaz kol midos rois me'arbas yisoides roim shebo. And in this animal soul, you have a composition of four parts, four ingredients. According to basic medieval science, things are a composite of four basic elements: earth, water, air, and fire. Mm-hmm. And you mix them all together in different combinations, and you get stuff. Okay? And so therefore, your animal soul is also made up and comprised of four basic components. But these happen to be bad character traits, because the animal following the path of least resistance is the wrong path. If it looks easy, it's wrong. That's generally the rule. For example, Dahainu kas v'gaiva miyisoid ha'esh enignam alamayla. You have, for example, from the element of fire, you have anger and arrogance. Now, we can understand what fire has a component. You can anger, when you say a person is an anger, you call them a hothead. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of heat there. So that's coming from the attribute of fire. So we understand that. But arrogance?
Because it goes up.
Arrogance, you could think, you would put it in with the category that comes later on when he talks about air. A person's ungeblasen, you know that word. He's just puffed up.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you would think put arrogance there. But no, arrogance, he says, stems from the element of the soul, which is fire. Because whereas boasting and bragging and these type of things might be nothing more than air, it could very well be that this person who is arrogant has something to be arrogant about. Mm-hmm. He could be truly in a situation where he said, yes, I am of what I am. But it's his attitude which has uplifted him to the point where he was. We see the difference between Bilam and Moshe. Mm-hmm. Okay, they were basically on par, one for the other. Moshe is referred to as the most humblest person, because he maintained that given the opportunity, anybody could have done a better job than he did. But he just had the best opportunities. You know, he wasn't stupid. He's not saying, oh, you know, the milkman's a better guy than I am, and, you know, could make a better leader than me. No, he understood. I'm the leader because God talked to me. Mm-hmm. That made me the leader. I didn't want to be the leader. I'd rather stay a shepherd. I'd rather be in Midian than having to deal with all these people with all the problems that they conveyed on me. But he was very humble about it. Bilam basically really had nothing going for him. He wasn't a leader. He was an advisor. He was a consultant, is basically what he was. And he was so full of himself that he charged exorbitant amounts of money for his consultation. Okay, why? I'm worth it. Mm-hmm. Look who I am. You know, no clean kite. Taivas v'tainugim yisayt ha'mayim. Then you have desires, pleasure, comes from the element of water. Because water makes things grow. Hmm. Meaning, okay, you say, what's that? And someone tells you, oh, that's such and such. Try it, okay? And you put it into your mouth, okay? And you go, wow, that's really good. What do you want to do next?
Have more.
More, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so once you get started on it, tainugim, they grow, okay, with experience, empirical repetition, etc. As it gets on and on and on and on, etc.
Now these are coming from the blood, or these are coming from nefesh bahamid, or
these are coming from bahamid? These are coming from the nefesh bahamid.
Yes, the nefesh bahamid is not composite, but it's creating this.
Yeah, the Nefesh Bahamas is a composite of four, this is the only time you ever see it, of four elements.
It is a composite.
Spiritual, not physical.
Yeah.
And from these four, how do we know that it's made, generally speaking, how do we know something is made of four elements? This is what trace is it leaving behind? What trace is it leaving behind? Uh-huh. So we know that there's heat in the animal soul because this person's getting angry. We know there's water in the animal soul because this person is drawn after pleasure.
Yeah.
Okay? We know halos latzanos etzaparos medvar betalim yisayda ruach. You have praises and frivolity and boasting and idle chatter are from the element of air. Mm-hmm. Now he doesn't say why. The first two he says why, because of a question.
It's kind of obvious.
This one says obvious. You know, and then atzlus va'atzmus yisayda offer. Depression and laziness are an expression of dirt. The person who's depressed just doesn't move. Okay, we talked about depression before, and he spends a lot of time actually talking about depression in chapters 26 to 31. Now, but he says it's not all bad. Because, for example, Gamidas Tevish Ibitevakal Yisrael Batel Dasan Kamay Rahmanas Gumilas Chasadim Boys Mimenu. He says, we're talking about Jews over here. Jews are nice people. So natural manners, you might say, natural personal quality traits that are good are also rooted in the animal soul. Why is this guy a nice guy? He's got a nice animal. He didn't, it wasn't, it, you could say, well, maybe this guy was really a rotten person. And then he got his godly soul to work on his rottenness. And that was able then to change his nature. But for the most part, no. There are essential core qualities which are inherent in Jews. Jews are by nature Rachmanim Baishanim Ugoim Lechasadim. I'm glad it rhymes, that way I can remember it. They are merciful, they are humble, and they like to do good things for other people. To such an extent, it says that if you find somebody who is claiming to be Jewish and is missing any one of those three character traits of merciful, humble, and likes to do goods for other things, it says you can check out this guy's lineage to see if he's really Jewish. Okay? This whole maysa with the six people who were arrested for torturing an Arab teenager to death. So I said, if it's true, check out to see if these kids are really Jewish.
Huh.
Because this is such a horrific, heinous thing that they should take somebody who's no way related to the crime. If it would have been the three guys who abducted the boys and they would have stomped their heads in, then okay, I could see that. Okay, but to pick up an innocent, not related, and to say, I'm doing this because somebody else killed somebody and therefore we're going to kill you, is totally and completely anathema to Judaism.
But even Nefesh Bahami is affected by that nature.
Meaning?
You're saying that Nefesh Bahami has, he's saying Nefesh Bahami itself has qualities of
this is the quality, the nature of the Nefesh Bahamas, yes. It could very well be, but why is this guy a nice guy? Because his mother raised him to be a nice guy. Well, from the time he was from 0 to 13 years old, he, you know, just like you have a, you bring home a puppy, and you train the puppy so that it shouldn't go to the bathroom on the floor. You train it so it should only go to the bathroom outside, and you train it so it shouldn't chew up the furniture or chew up your shoes. You train it not to bark at night, or whatever else you train your little puppy to do. And you get it so that by the time the dog's a little grown-up dog, the dog knows what to do, and this is the way it acts, and you say, good dog.
So that all the qualities we learn, I mean, I guess it's probably a Nefesh Elokim emerges over time, but certainly from 0 to 8, 0 to 10, all that is conditioning Nefesh Bahami. That's not
correct.
Really engaging Nefesh Elokim, which is not there.
It's not there. That's training, that the job of the parent is, children don't have mitzvahs. It is a mitzvah for the parents to educate the children.
Children don't get they don't get credit for the mitzvahs they do?
No. You get credit when your kid puts a quarter in a tzedakah pushka, you get credit for educating the kid.
But we won't tell them that either.
No, you won't tell them either. No. Okay? It's all their part of their chinuch, which is your obligation.
Yes.
Okay, so that hopefully by the time they hit 13... and they're on their own, and you've got nothing doing with them anymore.
But at that point, hopefully you've conditioned Nefesh Bahami that it will say, oh,
yes.
Right, my parents asked me to do stuff like this, so does Nefesh Elokim. I'm used to this.
Right.
Okay.
So the Nefesh Elokim doesn't have to take care of that. It'll have other things to take care of. Believe me, there's plenty of work. Ki b'Yisrael Nefesh de klipa hum eklipas noga. He's going to talk about this in chapters 6 and 7. Just to not go into it over here, because our godly soul, which is a product of the extraneous forces, comes from a level of extraneous force which is elevatable. That's all how we're going to translate klipas noga at this point. Mm-hmm. Klipas noga means elevatable evil, meaning it's got nice in it. It's got good stuff in it going. Sheyesh v'gam kein tov. that it also has nice things in it. And that's what the deal was with the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that good and evil got all mixed up. And so something which we call evil, like an animal soul, has good in it. Then he says, hold on. It says here, umois. If you look back in the Luach HaTikun, which is the addended corrections, It says umos ha'ovdei alilim. What it says over there is just plain umos ha'olam. It's to avoid problems with the Russian government. The author put in certain catchphrases. He never refers to non-Jews as non-Jews. Because then the Russians will say, wait a minute, you're talking about me. I don't like what you write over there. I'm going to take your book and burn it. So being pragmatic, so he wrote over there, the souls of the idolaters. Russians don't consider themselves idolaters. What did he really mean to say? The souls of the non-Jews. He says, the souls of the non-Jews. Hain mishar klipas atameis. They are from the unelevatable levels of the forces of evil, the extraneous forces. She'ein behem tov klal, which don't have good mixed in there at all. I'll explain this as we go. He'll explain it here. It says in the Kabbalah. What does it say there? The kol tivo de avdin umas ha'olam legarmehu avdin. That whenever a non-Jew does something good, they're doing it for their own benefit. This is, for the average liberal, this seems like really hard to swallow.
It's problematic.
This is very problematic. Because, you know, lots of really nice non-Jews.
And there's also the concept of a righteous Gentile.
Yeah, righteous Gentiles are different. Because a righteous Gentile, their soul is derived from Klipas Noga. It is elevatable. When Mashiach comes, all the righteous Gentiles will be resurrected as well. Because they have this spark of holiness which is able to be elevated. The ones who have come from Sholosh Klipas HaTameis, they're not coming back. Because they didn't do anything that they deserve to come back, you might say. Okay? So now, I've been challenged on this many times. Somebody who, half a dozen years ago, challenged me on this point and said, this is a breaking point. I don't know if I can continue.
That's right in chapter 1.
Chapter 1. The Alter Rebbe doesn't pull
punches. Bury this in chapter 13 or something.
Yeah, or 50.
Yeah.
Yes. So this person ran an office of 30 people. He was the only Jew in the office. He's the boss. And I said to him, listen, okay, I'm giving you homework. Next week, I want you to ask all of your employees, if they do something good for somebody else, why are they doing something good? Okay? 30 out of 30 said, I'm doing it because I'm getting something out of it.
Which including is what, it makes me feel good.
It makes me feel good. It's my ticket to heaven. This type of stuff. You know, all these type of things. And every one of them was doing it for their piece of the action. This also is a difference between martyrdom among Jews and martyrdom among among non-Jews. Why is there martyrdom among, say, like the Muslims? Why do they allow themselves to be martyred? Because they're told, after you get through getting blown up, which you won't feel anything because that just takes a second, you get the 70 virgins and you get the paradise and it's going to be so wonderful, it'll be very nice, and they're going, great, it's a whole lot better than what I got here. Okay, that's the martyrdom that they're enjoying. By Jews, first of all, Jews don't want to do martyrdom. We're not interested. You get weird people like Rabbi Akiva who said, listen, I'd really like to, if I got to go, I'd want to go as a martyr. Okay, but for the most part, we don't condone it. I tell people, don't try martyrdom at home, folks. The reason why a Jew would suffer martyrdom is because they can't separate themselves from Hashem. They can't do something. When it comes to that kind of push comes to shove, what that means is that they have to unplug their yechida, which is a connection to God. And a Jew can't do that. A Jew can't separate himself from God. So they're not doing it to say, well, this is what I get out of the deal. I get a high place in heaven because I get to do this. Nobody's thinking that. They're doing it because this is what you got to do. Mostly, I think it's like Jewish, just to be flippant, it's Jewish arrogance. You know, somebody says, I'm going to do this or I'm going to kill you. And so I say, F you, I'm not doing it. You know, pardon my French. So I'm not doing it. I'm going to listen to you. Ha! I'll tell you, which is the Yiddish expression, you know, so. And then it says also in the Gemara, V'kol tiva de umas ha'olam, there is a verse that says that the kindness of the nations is sin. Any good that the non-Jews do, they only do it for their own self-aggrandizement. And then if you look in that Gemara, there are many explanations of that verse. None of them are kind to non-Jews. Okay, but this one the Alter Rebbe chooses, this is actually the middle one. There are five reasons given there. I don't remember what the five are. On top of that, this is the middle one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this one it fits in it, you might say, is like, this is at least the nicest one. Okay, he's doing it so that people can say, look what a nice guy he is. At the very least, people should recognize this guy is a nice guy. Okay, that.
I heard someone describe this as, that you could really look at this as at a subliminal subconscious level, that non-Jewish people certainly can be altruistic and other-centered and do good things, but really in a very subtle way, there's some trace of self-served energy left in it, whereas you know, what's being expressed that a Jewish soul could completely
we would have to do like experiment, you know. So, but I will tell you that in sixth grade, we used to have these things called spelling tests. From second grade through sixth grade, every Monday we got 10 spelling words, and we got a spelling quiz on Monday. If you got all 10 words right, you were done for the week. If you got even one wrong, you had to take the quiz again, same 10 words on Wednesday. If you got them all right, good. If you didn't, you had to take a test again on Friday. And Friday's grade was what you got. If you didn't get 100, that's what you got. So, sixth grade. Mr. Yohanan's sixth grade class. I asked Mr. Yohanan, what does the word altruism mean? And Mr. Yohanan said, altruism is a myth. And I looked at him quizzically, and he said, look it up in your dictionary that you got sitting on your desk. Okay, so according to Mr. Yohanan, who is a non-Jew from North Dakota, people don't do anything expecting not to get anything for it. They're just doing it out of the goodness of their heart. Okay, was he a cynic? I don't know. Listen, he was 35 years old. I was 11. So in his experience in life, there's no such thing as altruism. So, to be continued.